Up first this hour, though, we get on the telephone line and welcome in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. His latest book, Scrooge, is available everywhere right now. Good afternoon, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Kimball? I am sitting in a field by the harbor. It's dark. Save these Christmas lights on a tree. I'm sitting here alone so that I don't... I had to remove myself from humanity so that I don't throttle anyone. I have to decompress. Good news about Carrie. Not great news about your school day. Shouldn't you be on winter break by now?
Well, yeah, and I only have to get through one more day, but I had hopes earlier today of a somewhat earlier vacation. But look, either way, this time tomorrow I'm on vacation, so I can't complain.
You are. Then you can do what you love to do and day drink and drunk text me and fat shame me and tell me all sorts of forms of abuse that are far too virulent to repeat to our good downtownian listeners out there. But wow, let me just say, people out there, Kimball gets a little big for his britches, as my grandmother used to say.
My grandmother used to say that too. They may have known each other somewhere along the way. Well, we've got a lot of holiday goodness to talk about this afternoon. And let's start with Sam Cooke from the recent 33 and a third blog, Sam Cooke for Christmas, that is really about, well, what a wonderful thing you can do by giving the gift of art at the holidays or anytime.
There's a lot more than that, too, isn't it, Kimball? I wrote the hell out of that bad boy, wouldn't you say?
I would say that absolutely. It is, what, it's a work of beauty and power, like everything you do.
That's a work of art because readers, listeners rather, hopefully readers, buy my book. As John Lennon said about his, it's only cheap. Mine is even, well, still with inflation, cheaper yet, and I need you to stock that in your stocking stuffers this year. So anyway, Sam Cooke, yes, he didn't actually have any Christmas recording. So someone might say, ah, how could you write a lengthy piece about Sam Cooke and his Christmas music? And I really would have liked to have had, I think it could have been a great one, a Sam Cooke Christmas album. Because a lot of times the Christmas albums, we like them, and they're on in the background, and we hum along, sing along, whatever we do. But not a lot of them really reach that mantle of art, I would say. I mean, obviously, like from King's Chapel Choir and all that stuff, and Handel and Messiah. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about pop Christmas music. But I built this entire piece around the idea of when I received Sam Cooke's Live at the Harlem Square Club, which my 33 and the third book, of course, is about when I was a teenager, like 15, 16 years old, whatever it was, lived in Connecticut, not far from where Bruce Pratt lived at one point. And I would get music for Christmas. And I think a lot of people get gifts at Christmas, whether they're sweaters or whatever, golf clubs, I don't know, that are perishable after a fashion. I still return, when I can find these things and they're not in storage, to the music and the gifts that I got at the time back then. So that was a big discovery for me at that age to get that Sam Cooke album. And then the piece goes off in all these different directions because I think really what art is going to want to be about the most when it's at its best is how it helps us and how it changes with us as we change throughout our life. And I come back to that Grateful Dead line that we've talked about here on the radio from Box of Rain about doing something to help someone else through and how Sam Cooke is a version of that too. And I'll tell you, Kimball, bet you didn't see the end of that piece coming, did you?
I did not. And when you talk about Sam Cooke, and you bring it up in the book, you mention it here in the blog piece as well, that he was a guy who could live in both worlds, both the secular and the religious as well, and was able to touch people regardless of what their beliefs were.
Well, I think that's something that sets him up, or would have set him up well, for a Christmas album, because there are two strains that often merge for Christmas music. You have the sacred and the secular. I mean, a carol is something that is sacred. We hear it in a church. I saw three ships, that kind of thing. But it's also sung out in the world, obviously. People, I don't know if they still do it. Maybe they do it up in Maine. But they go caroling, and so they're literally walking door to door out among the populace, and they're singing these sacred songs. So Sam Cooke was with the Soul Stirrers, and the book goes into all of that. The 1955 live recording he made with them in L.A. that presages Live at the Harlem Square Club in all those years later, less than a decade later. So he had both sides of the street covered, and I think that would have set him up well to record a Christmas album in the vein of his concept album of the night, Nightbeat. You can totally hear, like, if you transpose that approach, that small band bluesy approach to those nighttime songs to God Rest You Merry Gentlemen. And that would have been great. But we do have this one bit of audio for Sam Cooke where it's a radio promo. It's like 9 seconds long. He's wishing people not a Merry Christmas, not a Happy Christmas, but a fun Christmas. And that's a quirky, idiosyncratic thing to say. It's a very Sam Cookean type of thing to say because we don't expect it. And I think the idea of joy is downplayed. I was looking at these people today who have these massive followings on Twitter. You know what they always have in common, besides not being very bright, entirely mediocre, all that jazz? They're very negative. Like, that's what they harp on all day. And
right. Well, that's what sells. That's what gets followers, right?
Yeah, I guess. But I would also play, kind of a Scrooge pun, devil's advocate with that, because I think that's all that's out there. I don't think, like, we can really measure it because we don't have people immersed in joy who share that joy. I would imagine that you can't imagine someone who has a much worse life than I do right now, but I think when you probably think of me, you don't think of me as, like, this curmudgeon. Even still, with everything going on, I have so many passions and so much joy. And I look at a lot of my own Twitter posts. They're in celebration of things that will change your life to the good. And people just, they don't really do that. It's like one of the reasons why I like Oasis and their new album when they were huge, their sort of crowning moment at Nebworth in August of 96. These guys are having this joyous moment on the stage. And it's a very, it's not stylistically like Sam Cooke. That's what Sam Cooke is doing at the Harlem Square Club, even with all of these tribulations. I mean, there's joy in work songs. There's joy in spirituals. There's joy in the blues, even though you have these oppressed people who are dealing with so many things that a human shouldn't have to deal with. So all of that, really a lot more, too, is in that piece. And really, I'd say the piece more than anything is about why I am here on Earth and my belief. It's what I think I do. Like, if you had to reduce me to what this is, the mission statement, this is what this guy's about, this is what he's trying to do, and I don't want to do a spoiler thing and give it away because I think it just naturally comes out better in the piece, but in some ways I'm on bended knee for people saying here's this thing, and again, I won't give it away, but it really just sums up everything that I try to be about.
You know what I was struck by in the piece as well was getting that gift that you got as a child and how much it has continued to mean to you for all these years. And I think that's so important. And we, I don't know, the way our society's become, sometimes gift giving and exchanging just becomes sort of a thoughtless thing, and it's gift cards and it's this and that. And so few people take the time to find that gift that will speak to the person they're giving it to. And what a wonderful gift you got with that Sam Cooke album, and wouldn't it be great if people put that kind of thought into what they gave for presents?
Well, I don't know that there was really that much. I told my parents, I'm like, look, I mean, they wouldn't have known, like, Quadrophenia, like they did. No, you know what I mean? So it's like, it wasn't very Christmassy in that sense, but it was to me because it transcended, like, I'm not someone who even likes the surprise gift. I like to tell you, I'd like this. Because then I also enjoy, in happier times, looking forward to it. It lights up my mind. It fires my heart that I'm going to have this art that I can just partake of whenever I want. I can take down Flaubert's letters. There they are. There they always are. It's a gift every day. It's the new gift every day. What could be better than that? I guess I would say I give gifts like that. I try to give them to, like, my niece and my nephew, but not, like, I don't give them, like, Dryden's poetry to bore them out of their minds. They don't do that. I try to get it, strike the right balance. But art is a gift that never stops being a new Christmas present for you. It just, it changes with your life, too, where you change and you grow into it better, but it's not like you were missing out on something before. Really, Kimball, I would say to you, art is all I care about, because within art is love and friendship. It's vulnerability. It's honesty. It's truth. It's beauty. It's the only thing that can engage my mind in a way that I don't get bored. And people can say that's limited, but everything falls under art's umbrella when art is just amazing art.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown Love. Let's move to a wonderful piece you've written in the Smart Set about trailblazer Joan Harrison, way ahead of her time. And what is it that made her unique in the world of film back in the 1940s?
That's right, Kimball. I am the leading feminist, and I look like an athletic jock, which publishing people don't like. But yes, Joan Harrison, who they haven't heard of, she was Alfred Hitchcock's secretary for a spell in England. And she got that job largely because she talked her way past the line of interviewees and won him over somehow. She probably had to put up with quite a bit, too, with him. Comes to the States, and when he did, and he trusted her. He trusted her like he trusted his, maybe not to the same degree, but she was in the same camp as Hitchcock's wife, Alma, who is the maybe most unheralded person, I'd say, in Hollywood, because she was, it wasn't maybe necessarily a Lennon-McCartney type of partnership, but her ear and her voice and her sense of language and how a plot worked and how dialogue worked was crucial to Hitchcock. And eventually Joan Harrison went out on her own and became one of the first female producers in the movie industry. And so the piece also talks about this film that she made, which was a sensation picture. It was one of those pictures like a proto-Psycho in its time called The Phantom Lady, where you weren't supposed to give away the ending. And if you've seen the film, there's really not like that whole sort of ending to give away like there is with the Psycho, but it was this punchy noir picture that caught the public's attention. It's kind of a greatest filmic hit, I would say, but she made tautly designed pictures that bore some of Hitchcock's style, but also still were her own.
You call Phantom Lady gloriously seedy. I love that term. What do you mean by that?
There's a scene, for instance, where it's on the nose, but by the nose, I don't mean the nose, where this drummer is just staring. He's ogling. You know how you can get, Kimball. And he's just ogling like this woman, and he's beating away at his drum. And you don't really see, like, what his hands are doing, but you see what his face is like, you know, all underbite. You know what I'm talking about. we're not being very subtle here. So, and don't be like, oh, okay, well, people in the 40s had, like, this. No, they were every bit as revolting and disgusting as everyone is now. Maybe they hit it a little bit better, that kind of thing. So seedy. It's what you might have called at the time like unbecoming. It had a whiff of the scandal. So
And
I like that sort of earthy punchiness to it.
And you write about one of the great character actors who is that drummer, as you call him, the randy little drummer, Elisha Cook Jr., who, for my money, I'm not sure you can make a good film noir without him being in it.
You can't have him in a film and not have it be good. Think of how great he is in House on Haunted Hill. He's so, like, myopic in that film. But he gives it its verbal scaffolding. Like, the ghosts are moving about tonight. Well, okay, dude, why are you putting it that way? It's like, the ghosts are on the move. He has such a specific way of delivering his very specific lines in that film. And you know him, you see his face, it's like, oh, yeah, it's that guy. Like, right away you know him. But I can't think of a picture that he's in, unless there's something like at the end of his life. I don't know. Was he in like some made for TV type of soap opera type of film? I don't know. But like when you see him in that prime run of the 40s, 50s, and into the early 60s, there's nothing he's in. It's not like, ooh, I shouldn't watch this. You should see his face, and it's time to sit down and spend an hour and a half there.
I thought it was very interesting, too, Colin, what you wrote in the piece about Hitchcock and his style and how in so many of his movies, the visual is much more important than the dialogue.
Hitchcock had his start in, of course, silent films. And his earliest masterpieces were silent films. And some people couldn't make that transition. It wasn't just Buster Keaton. When I say Buster Keaton, I mean as an actor, because once Buster Keaton had talk, it didn't go as well. And that's a lot of what Singing in the Rain is about, the people who can make that transition and those who couldn't. Like, there's the woman with the funny voice, like, it's all hot. And then you hear her talk, it's like, oh, no. Next, we'll call you. Don't call us, type of thing. So Hitchcock mastered that visual vocabulary, and he never got it out of his system. And it became a form of shorthand in his filmmaking where, like I was writing on Twitter the other night, I don't like spectacle. I don't like when I know how something is going to work out and I now have to sit through it, whether I have to sit through it for a half hour, like A Chariot Race with Ben-Hur, or for 30 seconds. So Hitchcock will be like, boom, there's this, boom, there's that, add them together, and boom, you got that. Like, piece it together in your own mind, viewer. He asked something of the viewers. He didn't ask you to, like, work and fill in these, like, astoundingly complex blanks. But he sort of also asked you visually not to be a total dumbass. So when you're not being a total dumbass, and most people can handle that, as dumb as they actually are, you're immersed. You feel like you're, it's like how I write. You feel like you're immersed in something. You don't even feel like you're reading. You're just having this experience that you happen to be a part of, too. You're on the toboggan. It's going down the hill. You're not doing the pushing, but you're also not standing off to the side watching. You're on the toboggan. You want to be on the toboggan, and that's the style that helps put viewers, or readers in my case, on the toboggan.
Let's talk about Christmas entertainment, and let's listen right now to, well, a little bit of history.
A Christmas Ghost Story by Mr. Harry Grattan, Edison Records. People nowadays don't believe in ghost stories, but the following thing actually happened to me, and that is why my hair is white. As though not a nervous man, I can never forget that awful night 4 years ago.
That is a recording from, I believe, Colin, 1904 by a British actor named Harry Grattan, and this thing became a sensation back in the day.
No, I tricked you, Kimball. That was me drunk on White Claw in my tub the other
day. Oh, well, impressive.
So you're right. And so this would have been, for a time, one of the better-known ghost stories in the world for quite a simple reason. It was one of the earliest recordings of, well, an audiobook, kind of an audiobook, right? And so, like, if you read it on the page, it's kind of gimmicky. Doesn't really work. But when you hear it with that accent and the sonic scrumminess, right, that scrim, that doesn't hurt. It makes it quite atmospheric.
Oh,
like,
yes.
Where are we? Like, this is adding, sometimes you have an audience recording of a concert, and it's not the soundboard, so it's not crystal clear. But you actually prefer to have the audience recording because it's like you're down on the floor. And you're really getting the vibe, you're getting the atmosphere and everything, even if the drums are muffled. So, this is an audience recording after a fashion of a ghost story. It doesn't last long. It couldn't have lasted long.
Right.
It's not like you could have sat there reading for an hour, given this is an Edison cylinder. And we don't even really need to go into what that is right now, but type that in on Google sometime, people, and pretty primitive. It's not really going to be like your Spotify, a little bit different. So it really packs a punch. And then at the end, when you read it on the page, it reads like a joke ending. But when you hear the audio recording, it doesn't come across as a joke ending. It sounds almost like a hallucination. And also, I like it because harm may have befallen a cat. And you know that I don't like them.
A Christmas Ghost Story from Harry Grattan. A couple other Christmas treats. A wonderful episode of our favorite, yours truly, Johnny Dollar from 1956, called The Missing Mouse Matter, the case of the disappearance of a very talented mouse.
Ah, it's when J.D. got a little whimsical and had some. It's quite different from the Christmas episode we talked about, the five-parter last year, the Nick Schoen matter, which is, I think I ranked it the second best Johnny Dollar episode. So that would mean one of the best radio episodes in American radio history. That's because people know what I think of yours truly, Johnny Dollar. This is the half hour, and Johnny is going to the home of an eccentric millionaire who becomes a reoccurring character. And he has to find a mouse that's gone missing, like a pet mouse, but it's not just a pet mouse. It is a mouse that, speaking of caroling, can do just that. And we get to hear various attempts by like other mice, and then this operatic mouse at the end. And it seems that, well, there's a cat in this too, that perhaps he's been snuffed out as a Christmas tragedy, but it's funny, it's cute, it's clever. It's not something that you can't listen to if you're an adult, and it's something, I don't know, can kids listen to anything? Do they have the attention? I feel like if I ever breed Kimball, I'm going to have kids who be like, oh, I like that, play it again, and I will. But if you have kids, maybe try it on them, because I think they dig it.
Yeah, it's very fun, and it reminded me a little bit of the old Looney Tunes episode, I believe, of the guy who had the singing frog. That, of course, would never sing when the audience was around.
Oh, right. I remember that. And the frog would have that blank eating grin on its face.
Right.
And it's, yeah, and I like, too, when Dollar, he gets the, he's good at doing these reactions, and Bailey was, where he gets these phone calls. That's how every episode starts, where it's some claim adjuster or whatever it is, some honcho at the insurance firm saying, we need you to investigate this. And usually he goes to see them in person, but they tell him a little something about it first. He has these funny reactions to it. And they're such modern sounding reactions too. They're not like, gee willikers, like you might think that you'd get in the late 1950s. They're noises that you yourself might make. And let's just say in the end, you think it's all going to come out fine. There's blood, there's an evisceration. No, of course, it comes out fine. That's the alternate bootleg version. You should listen to it, though. It's great.
It is indeed, absolutely. And finally, well, some radio royalty. Orson Welles teaming up with the great Norman Corwin for the plot to overthrow Christmas.
Corwin wrote this. He was like the grand poobah of radio to someone like Orson Welles. I mean, Welles really talks reverentially about him at the beginning, doesn't he?
Yeah, about Corwin, and also his fellow actor Ray Collins.
Yeah, he's for a guy who is supposed to be like so haughty, arrogant, full of himself. I think it's like me that when I see someone who's actually good at something, I have no problem speaking profusely about their abilities. I think Welles was the same way. You can tell that he believes what he's saying. And the premise here is that it's going to be the denizens of hell who are upset, Mephisto especially, the devil, that Christmas is just going so well up in the world. And it's sort of distracting people, I guess, from, I mean, I don't know, like pillaging and arson, whatever, who knows. But there are things that they want people to be doing. And so they're going to send an emissary up to, it sounds a little dark, to assassinate Santa Claus. And I guess, like, I don't know, I've heard people say it's annoying. I don't think it's annoying. I think it's quite clever. They speak in these rhyming, everyone speaks for the most part in rhyming couplets, but you have this one entity, Greek chorus sort of person, a character named Soto Voce. You have the word Stygian, just means like a kind of hell-like river, featuring in the just natural dialogue of this, and you have Nero. So it's like you'd have to not be a total moron at the time, or now, maybe now it's like a different language, to follow along with this. So Orson Welles plays Nero, and people can look up Nero if you don't know who he is. Bad dude. they don't really get into some of the things. I mean, I guess you could look at it this way. Nero had a good time. I don't know if it was worth it for him, ultimately, with the whole Hades thing. But Welles is Nero. He draws the short straw, so to speak. And he travels. The travel is pretty funny. They're like, don't worry about it. We'll just beam you up. But you're going to be like 500 miles away. You kind of have to trek through the snow. You'll figure it out. He asks directions. He asks an Eskimo. And it's funny when the Eskimo keeps up like the rhyming scheme, too, even
yes.
though he can't speak English. And eventually he comes to Santa Claus, and he takes him out. No, he doesn't take him out. Santa wins him. He wins over his black, grinchy little heart and gives him, well, Kimball, we always seem to come full circle. He gives him a Christmas present of great art. Wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, yeah. Have I ever told you my Norman Corwin story?
Did you know?
This is, I don't know, I want to say maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I found this wonderful Norman Corwin short story, and I wanted to do it as a high school play with my theater group, and I couldn't find any place to apply for the rights, and so I just wrote an email to the Corwin Estate, and a few weeks went by, and I got an email back, and it was from Norman Corwin's daughter, Diane, who said, oh, this is such wonderful news. I love this story. It's a story called The Odyssey of Runyon Jones, about a little boy who goes to heaven to try and get his dead dog back. And she said, I love that story so much, and we would love to have you perform it. Thank you for keeping my father's work alive. And they said, you can do it. You don't even need to pay a rights fee. And it was a wonderful little message from Norman's daughter.
I was going to say that he was one of those people who was so household famous at the time, but now there really isn't anyone. Like, even in radio circles, his name comes up quite infrequently. Do you know what I mean? So it's
right.
Like, and these things are cyclical. Sometimes people, they come back. And well, like, we could have said that once back in the day about Buster Keaton. Like, he just was obsolete after his death. Charlie Chaplin and completely eclipsed him, and no one was really interested in Buster Keaton. He was a name that people, even like cinephiles, often didn't know. And then he became someone who moved back into vogue. But Corwin, he's like that. He would have been huge at the time. Like, Wells was genuflecting in some ways. He's like, no, this guy he's the master. And that's big praise from someone like Orson Welles in the radio. So it's interesting that he is, do you know anyone who would know his name, like right now?
Well, I think you'd have to be an old-time radio fan to have any idea, even though he came back in the 70s and wrote several scripts for the new CBS Radio Mystery Theater.
You know who he reminds me a little bit of is Gene Shepard.
Yes.
A Christmas Story, where they had a similar kind of thing where they were writers. They were sort of like short story writers, almost like a James Thurber type of thing, where you're in between and you happen to find this perfect niche of the short form. But the short form wasn't a short story. It was more like that radio. It was more what David Brent in The Office calls an anecdotalist. Remember that? I'm an anecdotalist. That's sort of what they were. And I don't know really that there are. Well, I just don't think there are people like that now, because there aren't people smart enough to be anecdotalists. People talk in these staccato 1, 2, 3, 5, 4-word bursts type of thing. But, yeah, and that went over well, the play.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, you can, of course, read Colin's wonderful piece on Joan Harrison at thesmartset.com. You can go to the 33 and a third blog and read Colin's beautiful piece on Sam Cooke and the Gift of Art. You want to give a gift of art, give somebody Sam Cooke, live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963, or Colin's brand new one, Scrooge. You'll make somebody very, very happy and fulfilled with all of that. Colin, we thank you. This will be our last time together for this year, because we're taking next week off. But thanks, as always, for all the greatness you bring to our program every week when you visit with us. And thanks for your friendship and sending your best wishes for the holiday.
A handshake and my thoughts to you, Kimball.
All right. Thank you, Colin. We'll talk in early 2022. Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Visit Colin's website, colinflemminglit.com, and subscribe to the Many Moments More blog as well.